Chapter 40. Overholt was briefing his commander-in-chief.
"So that's where we are, Mr. President," Overholt said early on New Year's Eve morning. "And you offered the British any help we might have?" the president asked.
"Absolutely,"
Overholt said. "Fleming, who heads MI5, said there's nothing we can do at this point other than have a couple of our nuclear experts from Mindenhall Air Base on standby."
"And you did that, of course," the president said.
"The U.S. Air Force helicoptered them down an hour ago," Overholt said. "They are in London now and should be linking up with the corporation and MI5.
What else can we do?"
"I have contacted the Pentagon," Overholt said. "They are preparing relief and medical supplies if it goes badly.
I've ordered all non-essential personnel evacuated from the embassy in London," the president said. "There were only a few because of the holiday."
"I don't know what else we can do," Overholt said, "but pray for a positive outcome."
Across the pond, Fleming was briefing the Prime Minister.
"That's the latest," he finished. "We need to evacuate you and your family as soon as possible."
"I'm not one to run from a fight," the Prime Minister said. "Evacuate my family, but I'm staying. If it goes bad, I can't let my countrymen die when I knew of the threat."
The debate raged for the next few minutes as Fleming pleaded for the Prime Minister to allow himself to be taken to safety. The Prime Minister held firm to his decision.
"Sir," Fleming finished, "you becoming a martyr cannot help in any way."
"True," the Prime Minister said slowly, "but stay I will."
"At least allow us to take you to the bunkers under the Ministry of Defense," Fleming pleaded. "They are case-hardened and have fresh air generators."
The Prime Minister rose. The meeting had ended.
"I'll be at the concert," the Prime Minister said. "Arrange the security."
"Yes, sir,"
Fleming said, rising and heading for the door. Outside the apartment on the side street bordering the Strand, four parabolic microphones were hidden on nearby buildings and directed at the windows of Labobiti's residence. The dishes picked up vibrations on the glass of the windows and magnified the sounds until everything inside the apartment could be heard as clearly as a high-definition recording. A dozen MI5 agents were posing as London cab drivers and patrolled the streets nearby, while others walked the street, staring into shop windows and eating in restaurants. At the hotel, directly across the street from the apartment, agents sat in the lobby reading newspapers, waiting for something to happen. Truett stood up from his seat near the driver as the bus came to a stop in front of the Savoy. He had called Cabrillo from his cell phone, and Meadows and Seng were waiting in front of the lobby doors. Truett filed off the bus, followed by the rest of the team, and walked toward the lobby doors.
"We're supposed to meet in Cabrillo's suite," Meadows said, opening the door.
As the team filed past, Seng handed each a room key. A few minutes later, they were all crowded into Cabrillo's suite. Once they all found seats, he spoke.
"MI5 has decided that there will be no attempt to intercept the device until there is movement," he said. "We will be working a support role in the off chance the weapon somehow makes it close to the area of the concert."
"What's the status of the principal right now?" Murphy asked.
"We have listening devices trained on the apartment," Cabrillo answered. "And right now, they're sleeping."
"What exactly will we be doing?" Linda Ross asked.
"Each of you is trained in disabling the device, so you will be placed along the possible routes into the area of the concert. We will wait there, in case we're called upon."
Cabrillo walked over to a cork bulletin board on an easel. A large map of London was tacked on the board, and a series of lines had been highlighted with a yellow marker.
"Based on where the apartment is located, these are the highest probability routes," Cabrillo said. "We believe that wherever the bomb is now, whoever has it will stop by and pick up Labobiti and the other man so they can place the nuke at the concert together."
You believe that they're going to hide the device, then set the timer and escape? Kasim asked.
That's what we're hoping, Cabrillo admitted. This type of device has a fail-safe switch that requires 10 minutes from arming to detonation to avoid unwanted explosions.
So you can't just flip the switch and start the fission process?
Julia Huxley asked.
No,
Cabrillo said. The Russian devices are similar to ours in that respect. They require a series of steps before the device is operational. The one we believe they purchased is a baby bomb designed for targeted destruction. The entire device could fit in a crate 5 feet long by 3 feet wide by 3 feet deep.
What's the weight?
Franklin Lincoln asked.
Under 400 pounds.
So we know they can't carry it or transport it by something like a bicycle, Pete Jones said.
They'll need some type of vehicle, Cabrillo said. So that means they'll need to travel over the roads.
Cabrillo pointed to the apartment on the map.
From the apartment, he said, there are a couple of routes they might take. The first is right behind us. Turn off the Strand down Savoy Street toward the Thames and turn on Victoria Embankment heading south. Once on Victoria Embankment, they have several choices. Turn at Northumberland Avenue, then head down the Mall, or they could continue on to Bridge Street and Great George Street, then drive down Birdcage Walk. The second possibility is for the driver to head straight down the Strand to the Mall, but that takes him through the Charing Cross section as well as Trafalgar Square, where the traffic is usually very heavy. Thirdly, they have a variety of side streets they could cut across and piece together a route that, while not as direct, would be harder to follow. At this point, we're really just guessing.
What's your gut feeling, boss?
Truett asked.
I don't think they are trucking the bomb in from some other part of London, Cabrillo said quietly. I think it's close to Labobiti right now. The starting point has to be the apartment, or somewhere very near. And if I was the driver, I'd want to get it over as quickly as possible and try to escape the primary blast zone. I'd drive down Victoria Embankment, make my way to the park where the concert is being held, then initiate the firing sequence and make my escape while watching the time. At 9 minutes, I'd be looking for a sturdy building to hide inside.
How far does the primary blast zone extend? Truett asked. Cabrillo took the highlighter and made a circle. At the north end was the A-40 and Paddington. At the south end was Chelsea, almost to the Thames. The eastern border was Piccadilly Circus. The west was the far edges of Kensington and Notting Hill.
Everything inside this circle will cease to exist completely. 1 mile diameter outside the circle, including most of the British government offices, will be heavily damaged. And in a circle 5 miles from the center of the blast, buildings will be damaged and the radiation fallout heavy.
Everyone stared at the map.
That's almost all of London, Murphy said finally.
Cabrillo simply nodded.
And we'll all be toast as well,
Huxley, the medical officer, noted.
Is that a medical term? Jones said. Toast?
Larry King walked out to where Adams had sat down in a field near the Oregon. Ducking under the spinning rotor blade, he opened the rear door of the Robinson R-44, slid his cased rifle in the rear and several boxes in the back, then closed the door, opened the front, and climbed into the passenger seat. Slipping on a headset, he closed the door and locked it before speaking.
"Morning, George," he said laconically.
"Larry," Adams said, pulling up on the collective and lifting the Robinson from the ground.
"How's it going?"
Adams pushed the cyclic forward and initiated forward flight.
"Good day for hunting,"
King said as he stared out the side window at the scenery. Hanley had arranged for them to station the helicopter on top of a bank that was closed for the holidays. The helipad on the top was used by courier helicopters that made nighttime pickups and deliveries during the week. But first, they had a delivery to make to Battersea Park.
Meadows Seng and Truett sat in the borrowed Range Rover and scanned the sky. As soon as the Robinson appeared, Meadows turned in his seat and spoke to Truett.
"Your Majesty," he said, "your face has arrived."
Substituting Truett for Prince Charles had been Cabrillo's idea, and Fleming had gone along. In the first place, the magic shop on the Oregon had the capability to produce a latex mask that exactly matched Prince Charles's features and could make it fit any member of the corporation team using the computer scans of their faces that Nixon already had stored. In the second, Cabrillo wanted a steady hand in the role, and he knew that Truett was as unflappable as they came. In the third, of all the men in the corporation, Truett most closely matched the heir to the throne in physical size and stature.
"Well, then," Truett said, "why don't one of you commoners retrieve it? It's damp and cold out there, and I am quite warm inside here."
Meadows laughed and opened the door. He ran over to the helicopter as it sat down and took the box containing the mask from King. He walked back to the Range Rover and turned and watched as Adams lifted off again. Adams crossed the Thames again, then flew north a little into Westminster. There, just off Palace Street, he found the bank and sat down on the roof. Once the rotor blade had stopped spinning, King climbed out and walked over to the edge and peered over the waist-high wall surrounding the roof. Just in the distance to the northwest, he could see Buckingham Palace Garden and Hyde Park to the north. Vendors were already setting up for the evening concert. The large truck from Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream did not hold much appeal, but the Starbucks display did. King walked back to the Robinson and smiled at Adams.
"There's food, bottles of water, soda, and thermoses of coffee prepared by the dining room in one of those packages," he said, motioning to the rear seat. "And I bought a pile of books and current magazines and put them in the other."
"How long you figure we'll wait?" Adams asked. King stared at his watch. It was 10 a.m.
"The most it will be is 14 hours, he said. "Let's hope they find it sooner."
Back at the Savoy, the team was dressing in the clothes Truett had purchased. One by one, they filed back into Cabrillo's suite for their assignments. Each of them had high-powered micro-radios with earpieces to communicate. The send units were strapped across their necks near their voice boxes. To talk, they simply touched their finger to their throat and spoke. Each person could then hear what they said. The three two-person teams would form a half-circle around Green Park, with the closed part nearest the Strand and the open part facing Green and St. James's Parks. Farthest to the northwest, Cassim and Ross would take up station on Piccadilly between Dover and Berkeley Streets. They left the Savoy and were taken to the area by a driver from MI5. Next, in the center of the semicircle were Jones and Huxley. They were assigned a position directly across the street from Trafalgar Square, near the Charing Cross subway station. If the bomb traveled straight down the Strand, it would pass right by them. The last team, Murphy and Lincoln, were assigned to the area in front of the War Cabinet Room on Great George Street and Horse Guards Road. If the bomb came along the Victoria Embankment, they would intercept. Depending on where they would stand, they could have a clear shot across St. James's Park. Since they had the only clear shot, Murphy had a bag full of small handheld missiles, rifles, and smoke grenades. The other teams were armed with handguns, knives, and sharp spikes to toss on the road and flatten any vehicle's tires. Cabrillo would stay close to the apartment. Along with him, the street was swarming with agents from MI5. Morning became afternoon, and still no movement.